Okay, we're going to be coming down real soon. This guy's about to pound a gavel, so stand by.
Appropriate, we get the fanfare here.
Okay, John, here we go. You ready, Steve?
I'm ready.
Okay, we'll be coming down in 3, 2, 1.
And we're back live from the Captain Cook Hotel to continue our coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board investigation and public hearing into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. The next witness is being sworn in. It is a Coast Guard official whose name escapes me at the moment.
We're working on finding his name right here. He is Frank Flins, Assistant Chief of Merchant Vessel Personnel Division. Let's go to the hearing now.
Civilian employee of the United States Coast Guard at Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C.
And what capacity are you employed in?
My title is the Assistant Chief of Merchant Vessel Personnel.
Do you hold any certificates or licenses?
Yes, sir. I presently hold a Coast Guard license as Master Oceans, not steam and motor vessels not more than 1,600 gross tons. Master Oceans auxiliary sail vessels not more than 100 gross tons, second mate Oceans any gross tons, and radar observer.
All right, sir. Mr. Woody, I'll ask you some further questions.
What is the mission of the office that you're assigned to in Coast Guard headquarters?
We basically run the national marine licensing program for the Office of Marine Safety, Security, and Environmental Protection. There's basically seven functions to that program. Seamen's documentation, which keeps the records of seamen, accumulates their sea time, and basically keeps their biographical records. We have a licensing record function, where we track people who have licenses, make decisions and policy matters on licensing in general, and decide matters of alternate qualifications. We have a section that deals with mariner's qualifications, which includes all qualifications for licenses and unlicensed ratings, and oversees approximately 150 nautical schools around the country, including oversight of the, as far as licensing goes, of the five state maritime academies, the Great Lakes Maritime Academy, and the Federal Maritime Academy. We have a section that does manning, basically sets the quality and the number of people assigned to each vessel, commercial vessel. We have a section that develops the marine licenses that we use as part of our qualification process. We have a section that deals with merchant marine veterans, and we have a staff that deals with pilotage, both setting, regulating pilotage, and also developing the pilotage rates for the Great Lakes.
Does your office originate any drug alcohol regulations?
Yes, sir. My office has drafted two drug alcohol regulations in the past several years. They have been done in conjunction with another office as well, but we began the draft of them and participated. One is the operating while intoxicated package, and the other one is the one that's not totally implemented yet, the drug alcohol package.
All right. I'd like now to direct a few questions to you regarding pilotage in Valdez and in Prince William Sound. First, can you give us any kind of a history or background of pilotage into Port Valdez?
Well, pilotage into Valdez is for coastwise vessels, or for all vessels really, is governed by statutes, which basically require the vessel to be under the direction and control of a pilot from the high seas into the actual terminal.
Are you familiar with any background as to the rationale for state pilots piloting all tank vessels into Port Valdez, including domestic tank vessels?
Apparently that's based on some agreement with the coastwise tanker companies to take the state pilot, but it's really a misnomer because the state pilot in that instance is acting under the authority of his federal pilotage license.
I'd like to direct the next few questions to pilotage in Prince William Sound, specifically from Cape Hinchinbrook all the way up to some point in Valdez Arm. At the present time, there's a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is Exhibit 9 Alpha. I believe that should be in your package. I wonder if you could provide us the background or the origin for this particular rulemaking and what preceding rulemaking efforts were occurring before this one.
Well, it's a practical matter behind this rulemaking. As I said, the statute requires the vessel to be under direction and control of a pilot from the when it leaves the high seas into the terminal, which would really mean a few miles outside of Hinchinbrook Inlet. The geographic conditions are such in that body of water that it's very dangerous for the pilot vessel to operate out there, as well as it is for the pilot to make the transfer out in that area. Because of that, the foreign vessels, which of course come under state pilotage regulations, do not take their pilot until they're further in by Bligh Reef or even further in. The captain of the port, under his authority, in unusual circumstances, issued an order which essentially excuses the coastwise vessel from the pilotage requirement under some very controlled circumstances. At some place in that time frame, the statute was changed to allow the secretary to set the pilotage waters in Prince William Sound. This is the one exception that I know of throughout the whole country where the secretary can change, by a rulemaking, the pilotage waters. After the statute was changed, we developed this particular notice of proposed rulemaking. Hasn't been acted upon, but during the comment period there, we received not one negative comment on the rulemaking.
I specifically direct your attention to page 4 at the top of the page, and to the left-hand column where it's entitled Prince William Sound Pilotage, and down here where it says subparagraph A, which starts reading proceeding directly to or from the established Valdez Whittier pilot station. What is the meaning of this text?
Well, the meaning behind this particular part of the text is to further narrow down the exception. It's meant to keep the trade open in Prince William Sound in that particular area where it was felt that may not require pilotage in an open area below the rocky point down to the mouth, specifically for those vessels traveling in and out. And if you read the part before subparagraph A, it talks about when entering or departing Prince William Sound. The idea behind that part of the text is to not include other vessels who may require pilotage and who are simply traversing the Prince William Sound back and forth from some other destination. It's not a blanket.
All right. Now, specifically referring to tank vessels involved in the carriage of North Slope crude oil that would be proceeding from Hinchinbrook up to Port Valdez, would this eliminate the need for pilotage for those vessels between Hinchinbrook and Rocky Point?
Yes, it would.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you'd received no negative comments against the enactment, or I should say enactment, but the promulgation or implementation of this regulation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, having not received any negative comments on the proposed rulemaking, in the event that this grounding had not occurred, what would have been the outcome of this proposed rulemaking?
We've been holding this particular rule for reasons not relating to the tanker trade in Valdez, reasons related to towboat operations and pilotage on those. Once those, if this accident had not happened, and this is pure speculation because, of course, the accident had happened, we probably would have solved the other problems and gone ahead with the rulemaking.
Right. Without a requirement for pilotage between Cape Hinchinbrook and Rocky Point, would there have been any other Coast Guard regulations, to your knowledge, requiring two people to be on the bridge of a vessel navigating Prince William Sound?
Well, the captain of the port order requires two people to be on the bridge, and that's still in effect. So the vessel, in order to take advantage of the waiver of pilotage, would have to comply, and there's several requirements. There's a requirement for advanced permission. There's a more stringent requirement for reporting positions. There's a two people requirement and so forth.
We understand that is the circumstances now because there is requirement for federal pilotage. But if federal pilotage were, if the requirement were eliminated, then would the Captain of the Port order become moot?
Well, it's pure speculation since we haven't gotten to publishing the rule. I would not assume that we would relax the regulations. It would just would be merely using this regulation and keeping the additional port requirements on the vessel.
Was the
but that is pure speculation.
Was the motivation for the rulemaking that of pilot or vessels that did not have? Excuse me. Was the motivation because of non-pilotage vessels? In other words, those vessels that did not have the federal pilotage. Was that the motivating element that got this particular part of the rulemaking in action?
Well, the motivation was to facilitate the trade into the Port of Valdez, and since the pilots was not feasible to bring the pilot vessel all the way out to Hinchinbrook Inlet, was to relax the rule so that the vessels that do not have a federal pilot aboard could still make the transit under some certain conditions.
Well, it seemed, in reading the Captain of the Port order, which is 1-80, Exhibit 9 Delta, also in your envelope, that the COTP order did make a provision for those vessels that did not have the required federal pilotage. And since it did seem to answer the problem, we were wondering why the need for a change in pilotage. Or if it did not answer the if it did have serious problems, we'd like to know, hear about them.
I don't think I understand the question.
Okay, surely. I think you said that there was a Captain of Port order. It is 180 and it is 9D, if you'd like to look at it in your package.
That's correct.
And it was because you were reciting from it a few minutes ago.
Right.
Now, this makes provision for vessels to enter Prince William Sound who do not have federal pilotage.
That's correct.
It.
And you're wondering why we need a rulemaking.
That's correct.
Well, the captain of port orders are supposed to be used in unusual circumstances, and this particular captain of port order had been in effect for quite a while, and the proper long-term fix would be to, especially in light of the change in the statute, would be to do a rulemaking.
Now, as a result of the accident involving the Exxon Valdez, has Coast Guard headquarters come out with any other directives or any other policy regarding pilotage in Prince William Sound?
There was a commandant's message changing the requirements. And I have not seen the message, but I understand it restricted the transit to daylight hours only and put some other conditions on the transit in light of the Valdez accident.
Okay. Would foreign flag vessels be able to, say, hire an American officer who had the federal pilotage and comply with the requirement for federal pilotage?
Foreign flag vessels come under state pilotage statutes.
But the state does not require pilotage, state pilotage from Hitchinbrook to the Bly Reef area.
That is correct, and that's a state matter.
The only requirement is the one, a federal requirement by the U.S. Coast Guard. My question is, would it meet your requirement if a foreign flag vessel had an American with a federal pilot's license?
As far as foreign flag vessels go coming in, into and out of our ports, we have no authority in regard to pilotage.
That's correct. I can understand you could not require them, but if they did have an American with federal pilotage, would that answer your Coast Guard requirements?
We don't have a requirement for foreign flag vessels. I'm not trying to avoid your question, but I don't see how you could meet a non-requirement.
I understand what you're saying. Does this thing, lack of authority to require a federal pilotage for foreign flag vessels, does that in any way nullify the captain of the port order?
No, sir. The captain of the port order applies to vessels that are required to have federal pilots aboard.
Does it apply to the foreign flag vessels then?
In some unusual circumstances, the captain of the port may make orders affecting foreign flag vessels, but it's not specifically aimed at foreign flag vessels as to pilotage. As I say, we don't have authority over foreign flag vessels and pilotage.
But if a foreign flag vessel entered Prince William Sound at this time, it would be complying with the captain of the port order, is that correct?
I really don't know how to answer that question. I don't believe the captain of the port order applies to foreign flag vessels.
All right, thank you. Now, since the granting of the Exxon Valdez, has Coast Guard headquarters made a reevaluation of the pilotage requirements for Prince William Sound? And if so, could you tell us what they are?
Well, in order to properly run the licensing program, we reevaluate the program on a continual basis. And of course, in light of a disaster of this sort, we're intensifying our efforts to reevaluate. So we're reviewing all of our pilotage requirements.
Specifically, just for Prince William Sound, do you have any policy changes that represent Coast Guard policy?
None that have been published so far.
Are you able to provide the board with what you believe the policy is, or can you represent to us what the Coast Guard headquarters policy is regarding policies in Prince William Sound?
I can only answer that by saying that when I left headquarters, the staffs were drafting possibilities to take corrective action. But so far, we have not come up with a policy on changing the requirements in Prince William Sound, other than the message I mentioned before, which is a short-term solution.
I see. All right, I think it's all the questions I have on politics at this time. Mr. Sager will have some questions, further questions.
Mr. Flintz, would you get a copy of Exhibit 10F?
On the witness stand is Frank Flintz, Assistant Chief of Merchant Vessel Personnel Division at the U.S. Coast Guard. He's being questioned by Mr. Sager from the National Transportation Safety Board Technical
Panel.
Why
don't we go ahead and start, and we'll come back and pick it up.
Okay. He has it, Mr. Sager.
The reason we're addressing manning issues in this hearing is because the Exxon Valdez was a reduced crew vessel. And we'd like to clarify some of the issues that are involved in manning and in reduced crew vessels. Specifically, what does the term manning of a vessel refer to?
Well, as we use it in the Merchant Vessel Personnel Division, it means the number and the qualifications of the people necessary, the minimum number and qualifications necessary to safely operate the vessel. And we set that through the certificate of inspection.
Is there a difference between the term manning and minimum manning?
I suppose so. The vessels traditionally have carried more persons than the Coast Guard requires. For instance, the most obvious example is the Coast Guard never requires a stewards department.
What does reduced manning refer to?
Well, if I may, I think reduced manning in the way we have been using it during this hearing might be a misnomer. What we really try to set is design manning or proper manning. And because of the way we do that, there is a step in the process where we actually reduce the manning.
Would you identify that process for us for reducing manning?
Okay, well, when we set the manning for a new vessel, it normally starts with some sort of conceptual meeting where we approve the concept that the operator or the builder or the owner has in mind. That becomes a design target when he builds the vessel. That's, if it happens to be a modern vessel that's relying on automation to carry a minimum number of people, then at the present time what we require is that the vessel initially be manned as if some of that equipment does not work as or may not work as advertised. So we carry additional people in case they have to pick up the load for where the automation does not work. We require that during a trial period. When that trial period is over and it's successful, then we take those additional people off the ship, off the crew. And that's the step where we refer to as reduced manning. This can also happen in another case, which is brought to my attention when Mr. Irasi was testifying, in an older vessel that is then fitted with some automated equipment, making some of the crew unnecessary, their jobs unnecessary, then we do the same sort of process. We make it go back to sea with the original manning, check that the automated equipment actually works as advertised, and then take those people off. So it's really design manning or proper manning.
Could we be a little more specific in terms of the actual chain of events that occurs, let's say in a new vessel like the Exxon Valdez?
Well, as I said, there's a conceptual meeting which becomes a design target. When a vessel is completed, there's really three players in the process. There's the Officer in Charge of Marine Inspection, or OCMI, who's the man in the field, who actually visits the ship or has his people in his command visit the ship and inspect it. And then we have the district office and then, of course, headquarters. So what would happen is they would propose the manning and they would propose the initial manning, and that would be approved by the district office and be approved by headquarters, and then they would go ahead and do it.
How would they support that proposal?
Well, there's several things that develop the manning. There are some statutes that require a certain number of mates and a certain number of people because a three-watch system is required. The design of the ship itself, especially in the engine room, would determine how many engineers you need to run the vessel. Now, initially, we would probably require that watches be stood. But the design would, in the most modern vessels, is for an unattended engine room. So then they would be able to go off those watches and reduce the manning somewhat. It's essentially, you would look at other vessels of the same type that have been successful, and that might be your benchmark. So that's where you would start.
By the same type, you're referring to vessels that are similarly equipped?
Yes. The manning is set for each vessel on a vessel-specific basis. So there's no absolute standard. If a designer makes a more efficient ship, then the manning may be different. If the equipment does not work as it was intended, then the manning may be increased.
Could you state what some of the kinds of innovations that existed on the Exxon Valdez were that permitted a smaller crew complement?
Well, starting with the engine room, the The Valdez is a fully automated ship, as I understand it. I haven't been on the ship. And it's a diesel engine room, and it's designed to be bridge controlled and operate without watchstanders throughout most of a voyage. So in that case, we require normally three or four engineers. In this case, we required four, a chief, a first, second, and third, who, if the automation did not work, could go back and actually stand the watches. On the deck side on the Valdez, it had incorporated some of the most modern things that you could have on the bridge, and that is all the most modern navigation equipment, the best invisibility, a remote calling system, so you do not have to have an extra person on the bridge just to go around the ship and wake up the next watch, for instance. Technology has overtaken that particular function. There's coffee facilities on the bridge, there's head facilities on the bridge, so that the ship may be designed for a two-man watch in the normal circumstances. That would be the mate and an able-bodied seaman. You need an able-bodied seaman because he has to be standing by to take the helm should it become necessary. So that would mean a master and three mates and then three able seamen. And then we required in that particular vessel at the present time, we instituted the maintenance department concept where there were three maintenance persons carried, all of which were required to have able-bodied seamen endorsements. Now, that allows the flexibility of either using the maintenance persons as day workers to do maintenance, either on deck or in the engine room, or should the circumstances arise, the master could set them on watches on the bridge as lookouts, for instance.
Did you say that all three had to have able-bodied seamen's qualifications?
I believe this. I don't have the certificate of inspection in front of me. I believe it says they have to have able-bodied certificates, or I'm not sure, but I think it says two of them can be substituted by a specially trained ordinary seaman. That's a device we use to allow entry ratings. In other words, a small percentage of the ABs that have to be on a ship can be substituted by entry ratings who have been specially trained. I'm not sure it's on there.
Who actually makes the decisions for the approving the manning for a vessel, a new vessel, such as the Exxon Valdez?
Well, the ultimate decision probably rests on the OCMI. He's the man on the scene. He's the man who signs the certificate of inspection. That's done with approval from the MVP office and headquarters, and that would be signed by myself or my boss, Captain Grady.
Letter. What do you get in the way of documentation that permits you to evaluate the manning at headquarters?
Well, we get a rather large packet, for the initial concept, it may include the design of the vessel, drawings, and a write-up on how they plan to utilize the people that they're proposing for the crew. And then when the trial period is actually done, there's a lot of documentation that we require. For instance, the overtime records, and the result of our Coast Guard officer who makes the trip on the vessel and actually interviews the crew.
Are maintenance records used?
Oh, and maintenance records. I'm sorry. Of course, that's the maintenance records are there to prove the effectiveness of the automation.
Now, once you have a ship operating with a crew that has been proposed, is there any follow-up? Does the Coast Guard monitor the workload for the existing crew complement?
Yes, we do. Every 2 years, a new COI has to be issued, and then there's a mid-year inspection by the OCMI. And then, and of course, if the automation is not working correctly, or or there are other problems on the ship, he may actually increase the manning.
What other things might be indicative of a crew being of insufficient size?
None come to mind. It's never happened that that there's been some evidence that the crew needs to be bigger. Normally, the example that comes to mind is that the equipment that they relied upon to take the place of some of the people no longer functions, and then they have to, of course, you have to substitute people for the automated equipment.
In the case of an inspection where maintenance appeared to be less than adequate, would that perhaps be a clue to or indicative of an undersized crew?
Not necessarily, because with the concept of minimum manning, companies often rely upon riding. In other words, it could be a factor of not enough crew on the vessel or not. Not necessarily, because with the concept of minimum manning, companies often rely upon riding crews and in-port maintenance and things like that. What it may indicate is that those functions are not being carried out. In other words, it could be a factor of not enough crew on the vessel or not enough in-port maintenance. We would have to look at that on a case-by-case basis.
To what extent is the ship owner or the operator responsible for safe manning levels?
Well, he's ultimately responsible for the proper manning of his vessel.
How is he made responsible for that?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question. We issue the certificate of inspection, which says this is the minimum number of people you need to operate the vessel. If the owner of the vessel knows or should know that there are other factors that we're not aware of, then he would have to make up the difference. As I said in the beginning, or maybe I didn't say, traditionally vessels have been manned with more people than we put on our certificate of inspection. Many times in the past, there's vessels that carry day workers to do maintenance, for instance, and they're not included in our minimum manning. But if the owner of the vessel, the operator, feels that maintenance is necessary for the safe operation of the vessel, or any other reason that he deems necessary, then he puts extra people on. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, exactly. There has been some reference to a minimum standard for manning vessels. Does the Coast Guard have, in fact, a minimum standard?
No, I don't believe we do. We have, we set the manning, as I said, on a vessel-specific basis. There are some things that become the minimum because of the statutes that we're bound by. For instance, we really need to have three mates on a vessel like the Valdez because the statute requires it. You really need to have, in the same token, three ABs because it required to have three watches.
What are the qualifications for a master?
Well, the qualifications for a master's license.
Yes, for a master's license.
Which, as we heard, may or may not be the same thing. And that's a good point, is having a master's license doesn't mean that you automatically get to sail master. Most companies have a rigid screening process. In order to get to be a master, a person would have to first get to be a third mate. And there's really two ways to get to that point. One would be to start as an unlicensed member as an entry rating and spend 18 months on deck as an ordinary seaman, possibly go to some training schools, get to be an able-bodied seaman. There's a testing process involved there, and there's a couple of additional things you would probably have to do, like a lifeboatman certificate. Then with a total of 3 years of sea time, he would be eligible, and I stress eligible, to sit for third mate's license. Most unlicensed people either don't make that jump at all or take a much longer time before they're ready to go to the third mate exam. And if they do, they normally go to some schooling, maybe several of the industry schools that exist, because our third mate exam is a four-day, pretty rigorous exam. Most of the people who are third mates today probably come through one of the maritime academies, either one of the five state academies at Maine, Mass, New York, Texas, and California, and there's also a federal academy. At that point, they would have had four rigorous years of maritime training, and then they would take this four-day exam, plus some other things like radar schools and firefighting and first aid and CPR and all that stuff. At that point, these two individuals would be more or less equal. A year of sea time would be required to go to the next step, which means 360 days at sea that we could document. And based on that experience, all of our licensing, as you've seen from my explanation, is based on practical experience, then a test. To the second mate level would be another four-day exam, and then the same process to the chief mate level, another four-day exam until he got to be master. The exam process, I would say, is pretty rigorous. Most mariners take it very seriously. And most attend schools before they actually take the next grade.
Well, in this case, we've had examples of both types of mates on this particular vessel.
That's correct.
In your view, was Mr. Cousins a qualified mate?
Not having his record in front of me, from what I can recollect, he is he held a second mate's license. He had been a mate for several years. I would say if he's reached that level, he should be a qualified mate. Now, we would have tested him at the second mate level, probably just about everything that you need to know about navigation, certainly everything he would need to know to do the job that he was assigned on this ship. Even at the third mate level, he would have been rigorously tested in chart plotting and maneuvering a ship and making a course and so forth.
What were his deficiencies then?
I think that's a matter of conjecture. That's something that's under investigation.
Well, I was referring more to his certification, his pilotage.
Well, pilotage is another license, or in the case of a lot of mariners, it's an endorsement on an existing license, but it's another category. What it's meant to do is to provide those knowledge of those specific waters over which a vessel is traveling. And the way you get pilotage is to make a designated number of trips over the waters and then have a certain amount of sea time, and in which case of a licensed mate, he already has the sea time and experience. But to do those two things as a practical matter, and then take a two-part test that we would give. And it's considered, I think I can safely say, one of the most intimidating tests that a mariner takes is the pilot's exam. One part is a written exam, and local knowledge and ship maneuvering and so on. And a really hard part for most people is the chart plot, which requires, if you look at this chart behind me, basically a mariner to take a chart like that may have an outline of the land, and that's all, and he would be required to put in all of those navigation aids and lights in a proper position, and the soundings, those little numbers that you see around there that are near the route, and draw in the route and the compass rose, and it's really quite difficult. So when you say what was his deficiency, I have to say it's a technical deficiency in that part. He was by no means, according to our licensing procedure, a deficient navigator, since we had tested him on all the things he should have known to, or did know, I'm sure, on how to navigate the vessel.
Thank you. In the exhibit that that you were just given, 10F, there is a summary of the evolution of manning from the 1950s through the vessels of the future. Could you trace briefly the salient points of that evolution, either using this exhibit or not using the exhibit?
Well, this exhibit is an excellent guideline. In the 50s, I have to make a count here. They have a crew of 24, which would be 24 people on a certificate of inspection. And I think we heard before that normally the ship would carry a few more than that. Included on this list, and I'll just, is the master and three mates, a radio officer, six able-bodied seamen, and three ordinary seamen. And then in the engine room, there's a chief and three assistant engineers, three firemen, water tenders, and three oilers. The first thing that probably happened in the 60s was an improvement in the way that steamships boilers were tended, making the job of the fireman water tender kind of redundant. Before that time, a person actually had to stay by the sight glass and by the boiler and ensure that the level in the boilers was correct and change the burners and all of those things that the unlicensed people in the engine room do. So that was three that were deleted. That takes it down to about 21. In the 70s, two things happened. One is the requirement for the oilers, it was deleted because a fully automated steam plant was developed where you had pilot house controls and the boiler, even the burners and the other maintenance that they had to do were automated, centralized controls and so on. Also, at that time, we began to delete the ordinary seamen. And the typical four-man deck watch had an ordinary seaman who was kind of the third person. One of the able seamen would be a lookout, and one would be actually steering or standing by the autopilots, which, by the way, have become much better, I think. And the ordinary would be the person that would call the next watch. He would be the person that would relieve the other guys so they could go and down to the mess room and get coffee, for instance, bring up coffee to the mate. And as I explained before, the bridge now had coffee facilities and automatic call systems, better visibility, and so on. So that was another person deleted. That brings us down, I think, to 18. And I think in the 80s, and there's something wrong with the numbers here, in the 80s is when we actually deleted the three oilers, I guess, on the final diesel vessels, because you don't need the oilers anymore. And that's also when we developed the concept of the maintenance department, which makes the remaining three able seamen or maintenance persons more flexible. And final comment here in the 90s is the possible deletion of another person. We haven't seen that yet, but it's certainly a possibility.
As a result of the changes in vessels over the years, have you seen has the Coast Guard observed a change in seamanship?
Well, certainly different things are required today. I think the emphasis on splicing lines and so forth has changed. I know we constantly reflect that in our license examinations, both our license examinations and our unlicensed rating examinations. We send the people who develop these out to the field to look at things such as the constant tension mooring winches they have on many ships, which probably didn't have 20 years ago, or very few. So, yes, there's a change, and we try to constantly keep up with it.
Now, I'd like to ask you a question that it really is a repeat of one of Mr. Danaher's questions, but in the view of the Coast Guard, how does a four-year degree equate with several years of sea experience in the deck department?
Well, that could be a difficult question to answer because I would have to give my own opinion, which I will, but by no means everybody would agree with it. I would say that we have a terrific system of maritime training in this country with the five state deepwater academies and the federal academy. It's a trade-off, and I'm basing this on about 11 years in the training business. It's a trade-off between sending a person out on a ship on the job training where you have no quality control and the training may or may not be really good for 3 years, or sending them to a school, some of which have been in existence for 100 years, with a highly trained staff in which most of his productive time is accounted for a four-year period and is directed towards one goal. And I think as I got through the answer, I just realized you talked about the degree, but I think the license program is the part that really makes him well-trained to be a mate. The degree is there for probably other reasons. That allows a more rounded person, probably one who can learn things a little easier later on. It also makes it possible for that person to seek other employment in the marine industry, which many graduates do gravitate to. I hope that answers the question.
Yes.
That's somewhat my opinion.
One last question on this subject. Is there some risk, and this may be a very difficult question, it may not be answerable, is there some risk in developing a group of able-bodied seamen, all of whom are motivated to advance to the officers' ranks, but not necessarily motivated to become or develop their expertise as able-bodied seamen? And if that risk exists, are we perhaps open to not having available seamen when we need them?
Do you mean, is it possible we could be making a mistake by having people overqualified?
Yes, and motivated to be something other than the position that they're serving in.
I don't think so. I think the people we have from the academies, if they're serving as able seamen, are probably doing a pretty good job, probably doing a very good job, because they are so well trained. And I haven't heard, in my position, we keep track of numbers of seamen fairly regularly, and I haven't seen a complaint that there's too many third mates and not enough able seamen. There are, from where I sit, there's plenty of able seamen that do not have licenses, and they're probably very, very qualified.
Is there any law to require that a master or mate stand his watch in the wheelhouse?
I don't know if there's a law that says that. It's certainly traditional that the master or that the mate stand his watch in the wheelhouse. I've never heard of a mate standing his watch anywhere else, other than someplace on the bridge. It's a matter, if I could elaborate, I think it's a little bit a matter of function. It'd be very difficult for the mate to carry out all of his duties and not be either in the wheelhouse or very close to it. I mean, the functions that he needs to carry out are probably, number one, to keep a lookout, number two, to navigate, number three, to avoid collisions as the top three things he needs to do. And if he was somewhere else, I don't see how he could carry out those duties.
Does the Coast Guard have any interest specifically in instruction or training for shipboard officers to enable them to detect impairment from fatigue?
I think the Coast Guard has, the only way I can answer that, it's such a specific question. Let me answer it in a more general way. The Coast Guard is participating in three studies on the issue of fatigue. The one, the National Academy of Sciences, a study of smaller crew, the effect of smaller crew size on fatigue. We have a study that we're participating in with the Maritime Administration on fatigue, and the IMO is doing a study on fatigue. And if it turns out that that is a problem, and the appropriate way to solve the problem would be to instruct the officers to be better at recognizing fatigue, then I would say yes.
Perhaps I put the cart before the horse, but why has fatigue been an issue of concern? Why are we sponsoring studies of fatigue at this time?
I think it's just a matter, it's the logical conclusion. As I say, I think it's required if you're running a licensing program and a manning program that you constantly review certain safety issues. And safety is our main mission in the Marine safety section of the Coast Guard. So when you start to reduce the crew, there are certain things that you wonder, are they doing more things, or are they required to do more things? And it's just logical to look into the safety, the fatigue issue. I don't know if there's more concern to it than that, in that it's a logical thing to look at once you've made certain changes.
To what extent does the minimum manning level reflect the need to operate in a worst-case emergency?
Well, one of the things that we take into account, perhaps I neglected to say that, when we set the minimum manning level, is the ability of the ship to, react to the emergencies that we can anticipate. Are there enough people to set up to fight a fire within the limits that we feel a crew should be able to fight a fire? Are there enough people to set watches, additional people in the watches, so that if we're in reduced visibility for an extended period of time, can we have an augmented bridge watch? And we do that. We have additional people that can be lookouts, for instance. If the automation in the engine room fails, can we set up engine room watches? Yes, we can do that because we have the people to do it.
Has the Coast Guard proposed any training for supervision of reduced crews?
Could you rephrase the question?
Well, has the Coast Guard, or to your knowledge, have you participated in any discussions about possible training that is devoted to supervisors of reduced crew vessels?
Meaning the ship's officers who need to deal with less people?
Principally the ship's officers, yes, dealing with fewer people.
I don't think we've specifically addressed it in that fashion, although, as I said before, our license examinations attempt to constantly address those things, those issues that change with the changing times. In addition to that, there is some industry training that deals with such things as bridge team training and the interaction of the people on the bridge.
To what extent does the environmental sensitivity of a route, such as this Prince William Sound, to what extent does this route influence manning setting?
Essentially, we consider all routes environmentally sensitive, so we attempt to man the ship so that it can safely navigate wherever it's going to be and not destroy the environment.
So are we saying that the coast of Alaska is as important as the coast of California? If you're from California, I'm sure.
From where I sit in Washington, every state's coastline is very important to us.
As a result of this accident, has the Coast Guard implemented any changes for identifying persons who might pose greater risks, licensed persons who might pose greater risks?
Well, the first thing we've done is we notified all our field offices to augment the wording on license applications and then also inform the individuals so there's no doubt that a DWI or DUI conviction is other than a minor traffic incident. We have that's by way of identification. We've looked into trying to get the authority to have the access to the National Driving Index, and that's the beginning of where we're going, those two things.
In this case of Captain Hazelwood, had you had information of his driving record prior to his last relicensing, would that have affected his relicensing?
Well, we have the authority to check into the character and habits of life for a licensed individual anytime we are going to issue a license or reissue a license. So had those facts been known to the local OCMI, he would have checked into it further and investigated it further. Perhaps he would have refused to give him the license.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Dr. Berkey?
Yes. I'd like to raise a few questions about the drug testing regulations that you had mentioned earlier in your testimony, if I may. I think you referred to two of those.
From KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network, you're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board live public hearings investigating the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. On the stand at the moment is a high official of the Department of Transportation, the Assistant Chief of the Merchant Vessel Personnel Division of the Coast Guard, Frank Flintz. And as happened about this time yesterday, he's getting a grilling from National Transportation Safety Board staffers about recent deregulation and the effects it might have had on safety. Let's go back into the hearings.
I'm sorry, did I see two? I meant 10. Beg your pardon. 10A Alpha and 10 Bravo.